And I'm very gratified that you've taken some time to work on this most important relationship and to build strong homes and families. And that's going to be an inherent part of a very, very important part of revival and sustaining revival. You have to fight those battles decade after decade, and the strength and the nurture of a home is incomparable in its capacity to help us navigate all of the things that we face as apostolics. So I'm glad for a great apostolic church. I'm glad for a great apostolic home. And today we're kind of celebrating and going over those things. Why don't we invite the presence of God into the house right now? Make this place holy ground by His presence. Just worship Him and praise Him a little bit here this morning. Mighty God, we love you and we give you praise and we thank you and we magnify you. So glad, oh God, to be a part of your kingdom. So glad for this day. Blessed be the name above every name. We praise you, mighty God. We worship you, Lord God. We lift you up, oh God, and we magnify your name. Praise God. Praise God. Now, was there anything in last night's information that just really resonated with you and you made notes and said, I'm going to implement this or make use of this as soon as I get back to the house? Anything in particular? Brother Terrell.
I really like the idea of touching and drawing close when you're having those intense moments of fellowship, and the humanizing effect of that. That idea, I think, was pretty profound, because it's much easier to stand on the other side of the room and throw darts than to be up close. So I really like that idea, and for the once in every couple of years that we have those moments. I'm going to implement that. So 2020, here I come.
I hesitate, but anyone else? Something in particular that really helped you or you found helpful? What have you been married, 5 minutes? Yeah. Okay. We won't look to you. Okay. Well, we really appreciate the good information and Brother and Sister Mills taking time to be with us today. So the police officer calls back to the station and says, I have a domestic here, and it's unusual. I really don't know what to do with this situation. And so the dispatch, the sergeant back at the station said, well, what has happened? Tell me what's happened. He said, well, the gentleman walked in the house and stepped on the wife's freshly mopped floor, and she shot him dead. He said, well, have you apprehended and arrested her yet? He said, nope, the floor is still wet. I don't write these, but I like them. So this is a real news article here. You know, the guy that said, my credit card's stolen. They said, have you reported it? He said, no, they're spending less than my wife. The guy said, you ought to take your wife places. The other guy said, I take my wife everywhere, but she always finds her way back. Said, you ought to hold your wife's hand. See, I can do all this because mine's not here yet this morning. Said, you ought to hold your wife's hand. He says, I do. I hold her hand all the time because if I let go, she shops. So at St. Mark's Catholic Church in Weymouth, Mass., they hold annual marriage seminars, and they always have a great attendance. At the session last week, the priest asked Cristiano who was approaching his 50th wedding anniversary, to take a few minutes and share some insight into how he managed to stay married to the same woman all these years. And Cristiano squares his shoulders and announces to the assembled husbands, "Well, I've tried to treat her nice, spend the money on her, and best of all is I took her to Italy for her 25th anniversary." And the priest responded and said, "Cristiano, you're an amazing inspiration to all the husbands here. Please tell us what you plan to do for your 50th anniversary." Cristiano proudly replied, "I'm gonna go pick her up." Okay. So, I appreciate Brother Mills and the good word of God. And I want him to come and just share with us and help us. And help us to have stronger homes and better, more vibrant relationships. And so that we can be the servants of the Most High God and build up the house that was builded long ago. Yes.
Good morning, everyone. This is because I'm going to call random people up here and question you about your marriage. Not really. You can breathe easily. I mentioned last night that this morning we would be doing a joint session about expectations. I think of all the work that I do with couples, and then of all the great revelations we got in our own marriage, is the need to communicate expectations. The problem with communicating expectations, I mentioned it last night, is that culture and what we read, all the things, social media, anything that puts any information out there, doesn't portray this realistically. Because it does that thing of you should just know. How many of you think that, like, that your spouse should just know? That you feel bad, that you like flowers, that you're allergic to flowers, that you, they should just know these things. And then they don't know, and our feelings get really hurt. And then we get resentful, and then contempt sets in, all these things. So that's one aspect of this. The other thing is, how many of you were raised differently than your spouse? Okay, this is where it gets super interesting, is when you start putting two radically different families together and trying to figure out because how it works. Because most of the time, we are exposed primarily to... I was exposed to my grandparents' marriages and my aunts and uncles, who were all raised just like my mom and dad. So everyone I had seen, they pretty much functioned like we functioned. I'll tell a little bit more about my story in just a minute, because I'm going to have my wife come and we're going to talk about. So with, if you got married after you already had the Holy Ghost and you were in church, there's this unique thing of, we believe the same doctrine, we go to the same church, we believe the same standards pretty much. There's just a lot of commonality and assumptions that we make that we're both Pentecostal, so we get each other. Like, half the battle's won, and in a large sense that's true. But then we get married and realize there's a bunch of other stuff other than what we believe at church that goes along with being married. And that's where it gets messy really quickly. So what we're going to do, and feel free to ask questions. Anything we talk about today, you're free to question it. If we don't talk about it, don't ask us about it. Would kind of be the rule. So we're happy to answer any questions about this. This is a topic we enjoy talking about. So I'm going to get my wife to come. I'm going to bring her chair up here because I'm a gentleman. And actually, I'm a gentleman because people are watching. We'll give her a microphone. This is my wife, Jolynn. So I'll start and tell you a little bit about my family of origin and how I was raised. So I am, I'm fourth generation Pentecostal. My grandfather started a church under an oak tree in my great aunt's front yard. And so we've just done church our whole life. That's what our family, extended family does, is church is our DNA, kind of, so to speak. I was raised in a really small town, very rural, very, very country, and everyone worked in offshore drilling. I did not have a single friend growing up whose dad did not work in the oil field. So everyone I knew, their dad was home 14 days and then gone 14 days. And so life just rolled on that way. So for Christmas, birthdays, anything, there was literally a 14-day window on either side of it. So the way the oil field industry works, typically the way it rotates in and out, you'd have 10 Christmases where dad would be home, and then you'd have 10 Christmases where he would be gone. So I have one sister, she's 7.5 years older than me. She gets married. Guess what her husband does? He works offshore. So then we have my brother-in-law's work schedule and my dad's schedule to wrestle with. So when we got married, we literally had one weekend every 6 weeks where all of my family would be in town. So like we could get married in September, November, or January. Like it wasn't just picking rent, and we could get married one weekend in any of those months. So that was the way it was. So if you had Christmas, you may have Christmas first part of December, first part of January. And that's just the way life happened. If you got around to it, great. If you didn't get around to it, not a big deal. All of our birthdays in our family are immediately after Christmas. So for your birthday in my family, you got your favorite cake and your favorite meal, and that was your birthday because you had just had Christmas. And so there were no birthday parties. I had one birthday party, I think, growing up, because also my family is like highly, highly pragmatic. And birthday parties, you just would not do a birthday party because that's not sensible. And so because you're going to throw away all the birthday party plates, and that's just, you don't do that. So that was kind of the approach we took to life. My mother was the most neurotically obsessed person with house cleaning I think I've ever known. If I was going to have somebody come over and stay at the house one night, then I had to take everything out of my closet and wipe all the shelves down, then put everything back. We wiped down all the walls. We had wood paneling in the house with old English oil twice a year, every wall in the whole house. We cleaned the baseboards every couple of months on your hands and knees, scrubbing them. When my mother claims, she will attest this is a true fact. We had a lot of potted plants in the house. You wiped every leaf on every plant. So when I tell you that, like, I have this concept of what a clean house was, I don't think it was healthy, but it was my reality. And until my mother had children, she washed all the dishes in the entire house at least once a week, even if they didn't get used. And she stripped the wax off the floor, mopped the floor, and re-waxed it every day, 7 days a week. So that was the way I was raised. Very, very rigid. Very, very little room to wiggle. I'm the youngest of two. By 7.5 years, we sit silently in our living room. One person talks. They finish their statement. Then one person responds and finishes what they have to say. And then the next person talks. and you don't talk over anyone. And it's a very formal, formal setting. Yes, this is a point of contention right here. When you get up, the first thing you do is you get completely dressed. It does not matter if you have no intentions of leaving the house. You get, when my feet hit the floor within 20 minutes, I'm going to look just like this. Every day. And I was raised that if you didn't, that was clear, clear indication that you were lazy. Like you were just not a good person. And you only changed clothes when it was time to go to bed. That was just the way it was. So that was how I was raised. And church was a big part of our life. Home was really, really chaotic, is just the easiest way to say it. Super chaotic home life. Super perfunctory, like gold star church people, though. So, and you had to be sure when you were at church that you really, really put forth the front that everything at home was just like it was in church. So when I tell you I can lock down information and keep a secret, like, do I release information easily? Like, I don't
know. I didn't even know about the chaotic home life until about 5 years ago. I thought everything had been totally fine.
And so that's the way it was. So I'm going to let her tell you about her childhood now, and then we'll sort through what some of this looked like in practical application.
I am fifth generation Pentecostal as well. My great-granddad spoke only French, and he got the Holy Ghost and went to a Pentecostal church where they only spoke English. But he and my great-grandmother went there until they passed away, living for God because they liked what they felt, and there was no French-speaking Pentecostal church anywhere around. And so that got passed on down through the years to me.
She speaks English, though.
Oh, yeah. Not that part. Just the church part. So my dad got married and had two daughters. My mother knew nothing of church, got married and had a daughter. Both of those marriages ended, and they met each other, got married, got in church, and 5 years later, they had me. I was raised in the home with all of my sisters. I'm the youngest of four girls. They are 10, 13, and 16 years older than me, and of course, then I am my parents' only child together. So our house is like, or it still is. Everybody still lives in the same town, close to each other. Some of them live on my parents' property. And so people come to my mom's in their house robe, their nightgown and flip flops, and everybody talks at once. All of the girls, my sisters, now have grandchildren. So when we all get together, we're probably knocking 30. And so it's just noise and chaos and fun, and everybody is laughing and talking, and no one has on shoes, and we're all running around. There's food everywhere. My parents owned a restaurant, and so I got to, like, I would ride the bus to the restaurant when I got older, pick out exactly what I wanted to eat. I did leave out an important part. My dad worked as a salesman for Procter & Gamble, and he took me to school every morning, and he picked me up every afternoon, and he was at home every night. We had family dinner together every single night. My dad was a lot of fun, very involved in my life. My parents, they didn't participate so much in school activities, but church, all of that, they were there. Just, that was life. It was the three of us. My sisters were all married. The youngest, the one right above me, she was the last one to get married. She got married when I was in the fifth grade. So it was the three of us, my mom and dad and I. We did everything together. And then, of course, I had all of these awesome opportunities to spend time with my sisters and their families and all this other stuff. And like you said, they all seemed to kind of get along just the same way that we did in my family with my parents. My parents owned a restaurant. I picked out what I wanted to eat off the menu every evening and when I came in from school, so I ate exactly what I wanted. And of course, the food was excellent. We could talk about that a little bit too. My mom is an excellent cook.
Mine is not.
In defense of my family's Christmas menu, just in case we don't get back around to that, my mother makes the best mashed potatoes in the world.
She does. You just shouldn't have them at Christmas.
They don't have a single carb on the table at Christmas except spaghetti and cheese.
And it's just as gross as it sounds.
You eat it one time a year, and it consists of spaghetti, just like you think it, you know, just spaghetti, with Velveeta cheese melted on top of it.
It's really gross.
And for me, any meal is about the carbs. The green beans and the other stuff, that's just so you can call it healthy, but it's all about the sweet potato casserole and the mashed potatoes and gravy, and that's what it's about. What am I forgetting?
Tell them about your birthday.
Oh, my birthday is July 6th, which happens to fall 2 days after July 4th. And so my dad took vacation every year because he already had that day off from work anyway, so he could, you know, tag on some days. So the week of my birthday, every year of my life was vacation time. And I was probably about seven before I realized that fireworks weren't for everybody's birthday, like that was not really about me. I was very spoiled. I don't think I was rotten. But life was really good. And birthdays, I don't know why this is, but I didn't have a lot of birthday parties when I was smaller. But like the last 4 years I was at home, my mother had surprise parties for me. Which, after the second time, it kind of stops being a surprise, but it was still a really nice gesture and it was a lot of fun. House cleaning, we had a cleaning lady because my mom was at work. And so she cleaned my room. I had to pick up stuff, but as far as like actual cleaning, she did it for me. I was very appreciative. She sat like with my family at my wedding because she was part of the family as far as I was concerned. So I was very thankful she cleaned my room, and I loved her and treated her like, you know, still, I still go see her sometimes when we go home.
The birthday thing, it's important that you know that for most of her life, she considered her birthday week to be a national celebration. And then having a cleaning lady, I think one of my favorite lines of our entire marriage was the first year we were married, and I said something about we needed to clean the oven, and she said, "You clean ovens?" I don't know if you remember that.
I did. It wasn't a self-cleaning oven, and so I knew about self-cleaning ovens. Do you know about self-cleaning ovens?
Yes, I know.
Okay.
I lived by myself for 5 years, too, before I got married.
So, like, we literally had to scrub the oven, and I didn't know that existed. Like, I thought all ovens were self-cleaning.
And so, we get married thinking we're Pentecostal. We're both from small towns in the South. This is just going to be smooth sailing. And then our first Christmas, we got married the week of Thanksgiving, the weekend before Thanksgiving. So we didn't go back home for Christmas because it had only been a few weeks. And she bought me a book for Christmas. Do you want to tell them how we spent our first Christmas?
So I put a lot of thought into Christmas gifts, and I knew there was this book that he wanted. I got like random, like covered all the bases. He got some clothes. I bought a book that he really wanted. So it's just the two of us for Christmas. Also, we need to talk about that Christmas tree, too.
Yeah.
I had all these visions of, like, Christmas as a family and doing things together. He refuses, and still to this day, will not participate in any way with decorating for Christmas. So gone is my idea of, like, you know, this big family affair with Christmas music playing in the background and angels singing. He's not even going to be home. He's not going to be in the light. He's going to get as far away from all that as he can. So anyway, I buy him a book for that first Christmas, and it's just the two of us, and I'm trying to cook this sweet little romantic first Christmas dinner meal, and all he will do is read the book I bought all day long. And I didn't have a book to read myself. Like, there was, I had no option. He was like, oh, I think I have some old Agatha Christie's in there, which is not my thing. So he's like, I think you just need to go find an old Agatha Christie. So that was our first romantic Christmas together.
Our Christmas tree, we were really poor. And so we bought a tree. And then the decorations were just pitiful. We bought these strings of beads and then cut them up and to make it go further. To, like, individual ornaments and, like, and put them on paper clips. I don't know where I got that idea, but they would hang over paper clips, and so it was a really ugly tree. It was just bad. Her first birthday comes around, and remember, up till now, it's been a national holiday. Our family, we've got a lot of leeway on when you get things done. And you get a meal and a cake for your birthday. So I had to work the day of her birthday. And at the time, I was working a good ways from our house. So it was a really, really long day. But I had the next day off, so I thought, well, I'll just go tomorrow and get her birthday gift and give it to her. Because, of course, everyone just understands that you don't do anything on the day of. Because, again, from my worldview, everybody's dad worked offshore. And so I didn't come home with a card. I didn't come home with a gift. And how did you feel about that?
The other thing to realize is that we live states away from family. So if I was going to get anything, like if anything was going to happen that day, it was going to be coming from this guy. And again, in my family's defense, every birthday is celebrated this way. They all weren't fortunate enough to be born on the 4th of July week, but they still have parties for everybody. Everybody gets together. It's still a big deal. So he doesn't, I mean, I think he said happy birthday, but that was sort of it. Well, I mean, I don't know what to think. And I'm definitely disappointed because that was supposed to be something special was supposed to happen that day, and nothing happened at all.
And so that was the beginning. At that point, we'd been married about 8 months. And so that was the beginning of, like, starting to realize we were raised radically different. I was raised where it's still this way in the town I'm from. By and large, the women don't work. The men work, and the women cook and clean. And that is as sexist as it sounds. And so my mom taught me to wash clothes. So when I was 13, I had to start doing my own laundry. So I could do my laundry, and I had one or two chores I had to do around the house. And then I lived on my own for 5 years. In my brain, and compared to 99% of the other men in the town I'm from, I can do more around the house than almost anyone I know as the male species. My dad, when my mom passed away, he did not know how much money he made. He did not know how to write a check. He did not know how to turn the washing machine on. My sister had to go put all of his clothes together on hangers. He had to go to the bank, and they had to close his old checking account and show him how to write checks. So I'm practically Superman because I can run a washing machine. But her dad took her to school, picked her up, sat down, had dinner every night. That just didn't happen in our house. So I thought, I'll go to work, do the random load of laundry, clean the kitchen every now and then. And hey, I'm better than most men she could have married. You want to talk about that before a little bit?
So you're just, he likes to work a lot. And I work too. And how many diapers did you change with our second child?
Okay, I want to preface it by saying with our first child, I did change some. With our second child, I did not change any.
We've already talked about this a little bit this morning, but there were nights that we'd wake up the next morning and he'd say, "Last night was a really good night, with it, wasn't it? The baby slept all night, huh?" And I'm like, "Uh-uh." And then I get up and go to work too, and I always.
In my defense, I cannot nurse a child.
But we were both working, and I took the girls with me to work as well. So they were with me 24/7, and they still are to this day. And he works a lot.
And so I would be at church early. I would stay at church late. And she would come to church with two kids in tow by herself. We were on staff at a church. I did the music program, so I had to be there early. I think probably my worst memory is the night it was just the torrential downpour. And we only had Georgia at that point. And church starts and she's not there, and she walks in and it was like storming rain, like it does here in the South, just that horrible downpour. And she's carrying the car seat by herself, and I see her come in the lobby. She's dressed for church, and she looks like she's been standing in the rain because she has walked from the back of the parking lot to the front of the church, carrying a car seat with an infant in it by herself. So that was not a stellar husband moment right there. And so this was the dynamic that just sat there for 15 years. Because I had this really, really rigid mindset of what marriage was supposed to be like. Our family can do confrontation really well. We don't yell. We're not passive aggressive, but we're brutally sharp-tongued. It's just a sharp-tongued, mean, contemptuous way of talking. And so if you did anything to put me on the defensive, that was going to be my comeback. And essentially, everything put me on the defensive. And so all of these things we're talking about, we can talk about them now, but there wasn't a day that we always could sit up here and laugh and smile and hold a conversation about this. Because she felt really alone and isolated and not a priority, super rejected, and I couldn't figure out why we had this gap and this distance. Because I was doing better than any man I knew. And those were truly realities that we had. And it sounds like, man, you're a really stupid guy. And there's some truth to that. But there, it really was, I think the big epiphany was not that many years ago when we went home for a birthday party. This is really the way it is. We went to a birthday party. It was one of my relatives was turning 40. They had the event at the church. They said, "It's okay, it's time to eat." None of the women moved. They just sat there, and all the men got up and went and fixed their plates and went and sat down on one side of the building. And then when all the men had their food and drinks and everything was taken care of, then all the women went and got theirs. And I was sitting and went back to their side of the room. They didn't sit together. That's the other thing you need to know about my family. When we have major get-togethers, like family things, all the men sit in the dining room at the dining room table, and all of the women and kids eat in the kitchen or the living room. It really is. Is this not the truth? This is really the way the town I'm from works. It's just that trapped in a mindset. And so I was sitting at that birthday party, and at this point, I had learned enough, and I was watching, and I thought, oh my word, this is really, really, really not good. Like, this really should not be this way. And we got in the car, and I was like, did you notice? And she's like, yeah. Like, over a decade ago? And so it was a huge conversation for me to be able to receive it, that like I'd done some things that were really, really hurtful. And she had lived a very lonely life for a bunch of years. And if she tried to tell me that, I would just get really mad and tell her how much I worked and how lucky she was to have me. Is that pretty much the way it went?
And because he worked for the church, of course.
Yes, then I can do the ultimate thing. I'm working for God. So if you've got a problem with me being gone, you essentially don't want lost souls to be saved.
That was a real conversation.
So, somewhere along the way, too, it clicked that, I mentioned this last night, yes, we were hurting each other, but neither one of us meant to. I was not intentionally trying to make her feel lonely and isolated. Like, I didn't wake up and say, you know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to see how absent I can be so she'll feel completely by herself. That never crossed my mind. So when she would get distant, she was really just self-protecting, and I couldn't figure out why she was rejecting me. And so this dynamic went on, and then where did this...
One thing I want to say about that, I could build up these scenarios in my mind of why this was happening. And I don't know if this is a woman thing. Anybody out there want to... I would come up with these elaborate things that I thought, well, this must be why. But it truly was for none of those reasons. He was doing what he thought was complete. He was doing what was completely normal to him, and I was doing what was completely normal to me, and it wasn't meeting in the middle. And so I kept, for years, when we would try to talk about it, it didn't really go anywhere, but we didn't know how to talk about it at that point either. We learned some ways to communicate that made that better. But for years, I lived with these different scenarios, like, and it wasn't constant, you know, come and go. But I think it's important to realize that those scenarios that we dream up, they're not reality. We're building something that they're not even intending.
And so one day, you're the one who brought it up. You said, I've realized you're not trying to hurt me. Do you remember that? It was a very important talk. She doesn't remember. So there was a major epiphany moment in our marriage right there when we came to the realization of we're hurting each other, but not on purpose. And so how do we start at least talking about, okay, this hurt me, what was going on when you did it? Without me getting defensive and me being able to give my side of the story, and her having some moments where she went, oh, okay, and then her telling me how she felt and me going, oh, okay, and us just understanding how the other person was literally experiencing the moment without it having to be contentious and full of tension. Now, I can say this. So the chaotic family, we do a great job of like suppressing our emotions in our family. So like we can be we have a lot of good manners and a lot of civility in public in particular. And the biggest thing, you could not let anybody outside the family know the family wasn't perfect. That included the person you married. They didn't get to know that the family was dysfunctional. So for 15 years, I just kept it locked down. It was just, I mean, totally locked down. That came across as a pretty cold, feelingless person, I think. I'm getting a good agreement here. So when it finally came out, it was a huge deal of shifting the whole thing, because all of a sudden she was able to realize it wasn't me. Do you want to talk about that?
And I realized it wasn't me. Like, all of a sudden, so many things made sense. We'd never talked about them before, but all those scenarios, again, that I was talking, all that stuff, it was like this aha moment, like, oh, okay, I get it now.
Which was huge for me. It just started such a, and this is kind of an overused word, but it's a true one. It just started such a journey of learning to communicate, of just figuring out how we were going to talk about it, and about me being able to say, okay, my family's really broken, because that's not words we do well on my side of the family. But to be able to say, we're really, really broken. And I don't, for me to come step up and say that day, I don't know how to have family time. Like, I need you to tell me. It was much easier for me just to get another job and just work more and just be absent more than it was for me to say, I'm absent all the time because I don't know how to be a father. And I'm absent all the time because I don't know how to be a husband. Those were words I couldn't say well. And when I finally learned to say, I don't know what you mean by family time, that was a huge, huge day. And I still haven't conquered that well. I'm giving it a fighting try. I think I can say that. But it's a learning process. I can tell you this in total transparency here. My kids freak me out because I don't know how to father. Because there was not that role model there. And there wasn't the role model anywhere. And I just, for years, I just didn't know what to do with them. Like, they just made me nervous. It's like, hello, little human. Ever how you got those clothes on, and ever what happened to your hair, it looks good. And you want to say anything about the whole parenting thing? And no? What?
Cool. What do you want me to say? It was difficult. It was lonely. But then, hearing him say all this too, so plainly, it touches my heart too. There's things he does that he doesn't even realize that he's doing an amazing job with the girls in so many ways. It's just not typical. And my girls love that. They love to talk about. He mentioned the Steak and Shake, meeting him at Steak and Shake. What he didn't say is it's usually like midnight, 1 a.m. on school nights. So they think that is the coolest thing ever. That when all their friends are in bed, we're jumping in the car and going to meet Dad at Steak and Shake. They're 16 and almost 14. So we are definitely not typical or traditional in any way. And we're all okay with that.
We are. Our oldest daughter's getting to the point where she's got a boyfriend. Thankfully, he lives 3 states away. And so we don't actually have to see him. But, like, I'm a marriage and family therapist. Most of my work is done around men with addictions. And so we can talk. I have certifications in trauma counseling and sex therapy. So I can talk about sex. She constantly has to tell me, the rest of the world is not like you. Please stop. Because it is not an abnormal or odd conversation for me, So we educated our girls very age appropriately, starting young. And it is not an awkward conversation in our house. And so we just keep that conversation open. And our oldest has the... We give our kids a lot of permission to talk. Our deal is you can say anything if you say it respectfully. You just can't respond with behaviors. So that's a good rule in marriage as well. That's not just a parenting thing. Our kids have permission to say, I'm really angry at you and I don't like either of you right now. They've told us that before. What they cannot do is stomp out of the room and slam the door. Because that's what my family did. We never talked about anything. We never talked about how we felt. And so we worked really hard to try to get our kids to a place where they can say what they feel rather than having to act it out. And it alleviates the tension and we can deal with like why they're angry, why they're upset, what's going on. It's the same way with us. And again, we do weird communication. The other day, I could tell she was upset. And I knew I'd done one or two things that were probably upsetting. It's the other thing. And so I said, are you upset? And she said, I am, but I'm also very hungry. And so if you will let me eat, I'll let you know just how upset I am. And so we went and had dinner. And I said, are you still upset? She said, no, not really. But is that weird? Yeah, that's not normal communication. That's not normal textbook communication. But we could have just tied up and had a fight over some things. Or we could realize where we're at and say, hey, let's do this, and then let's revisit it. And that's okay to do that. So learning to say what you're scared to say is a huge thing. Like, again, me being able to say, I don't know how to parent. I don't know how to father. That wasn't an easy thing for me to say because I like being proficient at everything.
Then you can wait and keep hoping that they're going to get it. Because for a long time I thought, well, if I have to tell him that I need a gift on my birthday, what does it really mean anyway? Or you can just have a conversation about it. And in 5-10 years, those feelings won't be attached to that conversation anyway. You'll just be happy and you'll think that he's just caught on. You know, you just kind of forget the longer you move away from those conversations. So you can have the conversation and go on and have a happy life, or you can spend the rest of your life waiting.
And this is a great example because once she was able to clearly say, I want something on my birthday.
The day of. Not a week before or a week after, the day.
So, and the thing is, it doesn't have to be a lot. When she turned 30, I did this deal. I flew her parents out to keep our kids and we went to New York City. It didn't happen on the day of her birthday. I got her a card on the day of her birthday, but the trip was her birthday gift. But she still wanted something on her birthday. Now, in my brain, I'm taking you to New York City. Seriously, I have to go buy a card?
Stuff like this doesn't happen every year. 30 was like,
Yeah. Because since then, it's been like parents and friends. Just kidding. But she wants something on her birthday. Me, on the other hand, this is the truth and it's frustrating to her. If there's not something I want when it's my birthday, then I don't want to get something for my birthday. I want you to wait until there's something I want and then go spend that money. So when the book comes out that I do want, or the shirt comes around that I do like, I want you to buy it then. I don't care if it's in March. And she wants to get me something just any day. I'm just saying my birthday's in January. I don't care when it happens. So she wants me to have like this special day with warm and fuzzy feelings, and I just don't. I think that's another thing is that's been hard is I'm not a warm and fuzzy sentimental person. And you are. Do you want to talk about your like kind of ideal of?
Well, every holiday is meant to be celebrated. If you can have some fun on National Pickle Day, let's have some fun. Let's decorate. Let's do something. Let's make something. You know, and I think all that probably just gives him anxiety.
David, open question.
Yes.
How have you synthesized it in regards to the children, the way you observe birthdays and holidays and those kind of things? Do you acquiesce? How do you learn the culture?
I think we've done well with our kids.
I think he pretty much does what I want to do with the kids because
I do. I really do. I take her leave.
That's a hill to die on for me. I want my kids to have special days and special times, and so that was a hill to die on. And that's another thing, like you just have to pick your battles with some things. I think we threw him a surprise party. It was his 45th birthday on the inauguration of the 45th president of the United States. So we threw a surprise party with all the little masks of Trump and Lincoln, all these other presidents, famous presidents. And I think he probably would rather we not have done that. But it was too, the coincidence was there, and I couldn't let that one slide. So you have to pick and choose what really matters. And he said last night, every hill's a hill to die on. He does give in every now and then on some of that stuff. And I take it and run with it.
And so, like, Christmas, she has very strong feelings about what she wants Christmas to be like for our kids. So I go along with that. I don't help decorate the Christmas tree. I'm just not going to. You can think poorly of me if you'd like. I'm still not going to decorate the Christmas tree. But I do go along with whatever. If we're going to be home on Christmas morning, then we're going to have, whenever she wants to have Christmas and whatever she wants it to be, I ask, like, what do you want me to do on Christmas? And if she says, I want you to, like, be present, we're going to open presents, and then we're going to eat, and then we can take a nap, and then we're going to go do such and such in the evening, and I just go along with the plan, and I'm fine with that, to do that, because our kids, we do want them to have, I don't want them to end up skewed the way that I was raised in that. Any other questions? We're really open to questions. If we're talking about it, we're happy to talk about it.
First of all, I want to apologize to you for the 48-hour rule. Not to be
able to. You don't have to apologize. I promise.
Well, I'm about to have to hurt.
See? That is me right there. I just assumed you were talking about me. I can tell you specifically why. There is just a ridiculous amount of trauma in my history. And it was totally locked down. And I was in self-preservation mode the first 15 years of our marriage. And it was literally just function through life. And then when I hit the wall, this is why I'm really big on dealing with your emotions. Your emotions will hunt you down like a mad terrorist army. And when they show up, they are going to stay as long as they want to stay. So if you push them down for 20 years, you're not going to have one good cry and be over it. It's like, we're here and you've neglected us for 40 years, and we're going to stay a day or two. And so when that broke, it like didn't kind of break. It wasn't like a light, slight opening of the door. I think you could agree to that. It was like the dam burst, and there like had to be just major work done immediately, and that's really what threw us into the learning to communicate well. Like, it became a necessity because I was very, very much just at my road's end of being able to lock everything down.
And we're only telling you the bad parts about all this too. There's a lot. He's a lot of fun. He's a whole lot more fun than I am. I'm into parties and things like that, you know, the event type stuff. But just as far as just like sitting down and having a conversation, he's a hoot. So it wasn't all as dark as we're probably making it sound right now. It came in seasons and times. And it wasn't all bad. I do think about wasted time and what could have been, but I think we could do that with anything.
And again, it did come in waves and seasons. Again, it hasn't been an easy 21 years, but it's been a fun 21 years. And that's one thing that I love about our relationship is you can put us pretty much anywhere and we can have fun. One of my favorite memories is we were at a really odd funeral in a really unique state. And it was just weird. Everybody in the room, it was the actual funeral. And we were the only two people in the room without a cup of coffee. And everybody was just sipping coffee. And they were having the funeral. And then they played this weird song. And when they started the song, I started to turn my head like this. And I just heard her say, "Don't." And like, we just know. We cannot look at each other. It's just going to go downhill from here. So we have fun. So the rich communication, it'd be great if it came later, but I think when it got here, it was learning, needing to learn quickly. There was a quick learning curve to it, but it helped us learn communicate ever how it works for you to communicate. And when we started sharing expectations, it really just life got incredibly better. Where we can have I've been in school 6 years. When I started school this semester, I had my last day of school. So she bought, what did you buy?
A chalkboard
that she wanted me to hold and take a picture. And my question was, seriously? After 20 years, what about me makes you think I'm going to stand by the door with my backpack holding a chalkboard?
I just thought it would be hysterical. Everybody else was posting their kids, and I thought it would be so funny.
Kids being the key word, like first day of pre-3. I want to be a fireman. I'm 45. I'm not going to hold up a sign. So we still have those moments where it's just like, that's not going to happen. And she's like, "You're no fun." I'm just like, "No, I'm not."
In the process of buying the chalkboard, do you really think he's going to apply?
Well, there had been a window because he mentioned that it was his last first day of school. And I said, "Oh, we need to get a picture." And he didn't say no. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to, I kind of knew, but I was going to see, like, I mean, it's been 6 really long years. I thought, like, maybe there's a little bit of celebratory something in him that's going to jump at this, but I was wrong.
There wasn't. Anyone else have a question? Yes.
Did your family 100%.
So our family, we tend to think we know everything. That's a safe assumption, isn't it? I can argue with you about something I know nothing about. and be kind of convincing. So I actually went to therapy, and I thought, I'm pretty sure he doesn't know what he's doing. And I went to school to become a therapist to be sure my therapist was doing his job well. And that is a really true story. Anyone else? This is your moment. If you've ever wanted to ask people personal questions about their marriage, today's the day. It makes sense. Do you want to talk about this? Because I think I'll have a hard time giving a balanced perspective, because when I left home, my goal was to be as opposite and get as far away from everything I knew as I could possibly get. So I didn't want a wife that cooked and cleaned, and I mean, that was in my mind. I didn't want anything like I'd been raised like. And so I've gone to, like, it's been really important to me that we not be rigid. We do a fusion type thing with our kids and their education, where they're part classical academy, part online, part will enroll in college. Flexibility is everything to me. If I want to get up at 1 o'clock in the morning and leave and go on a trip, I want the ability to do that, because that's something we would have never have done. She went to college. She started her own business. She owns her own company. So I go really far to the other extreme of, I don't want anything like I was raised like. So you may be able to speak more to, like, traditional.
Is that what you're asking?
This is what the research says. 66% of marital conflicts are non-resolvable. And so you have to identify what is non-resolvable and how you work around that, and then figure out what is resolvable. And when I say non-resolvable, I am a worker. If you give me the option of a vacation or being able to work, I'm going to pick work. If you give me the option of being able to sit still or be busy, I'm going to be busy. Is that true? Like, in my mind, if you're not working at least two jobs, possibly three, then your work ethic may be a little sketchy. So I'm really, really unbalanced in that part of my life. However, I know that. That is why I go to her on days about Christmas. Like, we're talking about what we're going to do for Thanksgiving. We're talking about what we're going to do for Christmas. We're talking about what we're going to do at different times, because I am so unbalanced. I'm not ever going to quit being busy, but I do owe it to our marriage and our kids and our relationship that on the days and the times and the seasons that are really important to her, to figure out how we're going to work around that. And I go with what she wants me to do on most of those things. Does that make sense to some degree?
Yeah.
Okay. Does it make sense for you? So it really is some of the things, some of the quirks that are in our personalities and in our relationships, they're not going to be resolved. I'm not going to be a 9-to-5 person, but I do, it's wrong if I don't say, okay, these days are important to you, and these are the days you've told me that are important to you, and those days I'm not going to do what I want to do. Because there's not just me in this marriage. There are two of us in this marriage. And I'm not absent 100% of the time. I'm making it sound like I am. We have our rhythm of our house and the way things... Our house, again, you're the least night owl of us all, probably. But if you come to our house at midnight, like, it's up and running. We may have one kid making cookies, one playing the guitar. Like, that's just the rhythm of our house. Is that the typical home? I don't know. Probably not. But it works for us. And we have a lot of fun in those moments. Like, we will sit around and catch up at 2 o'clock in the morning. The other night it was like 1:30 and both of the kids were sitting on the foot of our bed and we were talking and laughing and having a great time and finding out what all had been going on in their day and everything. And I think what we've done has worked well. I'll give us credit for this. Our daughter's 16-year-old boyfriend that we don't want to like, but he's so likable, came for a visit. And they I still think this is so weird. They want us to go out with them. Like, when they go eat and stuff, they're like, can y'all go with us? Do what? That was rude. No, I really didn't hear what you said. But, like, we go. And I don't think there's a lot of 16-year-old kids that are asking their parents to go hang out with them. And so I don't know how that happened, really, but somewhere along the way, we did enough that our kids think we're cool enough to go out with their boyfriends and girlfriends. And so, whatever works, works. So when we began to be able to tell each other, this is what I need from you, this is what I want from you, when we were able to start saying things like, that really hurt my feelings. Just being able to say things. This has been a couple months ago. I said something. We were in the car and I said something. You had a really strong response. And I said, I was just simply telling you what I observed. And I was kind of snappy with my remark. Then I got out and went to the store and I came back. And she's like, you know what? I don't know why I responded strongly, but I really did overreact and I'm sorry. Quick interchange or exchange there, but it resolved the issue. And so just that learning to do that, is it easy? 100% no. It's not easy. Does it make for a much, much, much richer marriage? Yes, it does. But we all have to be willing to give. To speak to your question, Brother Sutton, is that there are things that, like, our kids, they trump how I was raised. They trump the way that we would do things if we didn't, have kids, maybe, because our kids, their experience is our mutual interest for them. And so that's part of that 66% of the things that it may not be resolved perfectly, but we found a solution that for this purpose, we resolve it well. And then there are some things that are resolvable. I say, okay, I cannot do that anymore. Or she says, okay, I cannot do that, or I can do that. So, before we, yes. Yes. Here is, I think, a really important key. Affirmation is not agreement. So it can be really important to her, and you don't ever have to agree that it's important, but you can still do it. And I think there's a power in accepting that affirmation of something, whether it be feelings, beliefs, priorities, is not necessarily agreeing with it. But for the good of the whole, we can do this. So she can be really upset, or I can be really upset, and I can say, I'm really, really sorry that you're upset. Because I am sorry she's upset. It doesn't mean that I think she should be upset. It doesn't mean that I agree with the level of upset she is. It doesn't mean that I think that what she's upset about was something worth getting upset over. But if I want to get stuck on those things, we're just going to fight. Or I can just speak to the heart of the issue and say, you're upset and I'm really sorry because I did not mean to upset you. And when it comes to those things, priority-wise, it's the same thing. There are some things, it's not on my priority list, but it is with her, and vice versa. It's not on. We went to see Brene Brown yesterday. I am a rabid Brene Brown fan, her not so much. I think she really went because she knew it was something that is kind of a bucket list thing for me, and she was happy to be there because I was there. But if she even said, is there somebody that you would have more fun with? Like, do you want to ask? My cousin Lane lives in the same city, and she's like, do you want to see if Lane wants to go? He might like it more. But if you want me to go, I'll go. And I wanted her to go, and she went. And
I enjoyed it.
And she enjoyed it. And so that's one of those things. Does that kind of answer the question?
If you're having problems finding those things or having a hard time getting started, for a period in our marriage, we would ask each other almost on a weekly basis, is there anything I can do to be a better wife? Is there anything I can do to be a better husband? He actually started that. We don't do that so much anymore. We deal with things as they come. But if you're having a hard time getting those conversations started, that might be the way to do it. And it might be that you do it every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. That's not romantic. But if you know that's coming, you can make it work.
Those were some of the most helpful conversations. And this is going back. This was in the 15 years where I was kind of emotionally locked down. But we had those conversations because I was realizing, okay, the way I was raised is not the way most people were raised. And so that was a safe way for me. And then it really started helping things. So I wanted to invest in that. Was, is there anything I can do better that I'm not doing right now? And we were able to talk about that and make corrections along the way. So again, yes, I did talk about some. We did talk about some of the dark moments, but the dark moments, when they were dark, they were very dark. But it wasn't a prevalent atmosphere either. It was just something that was there. Any other questions? Yes. No, it's a real deal. That's my favorite answer. Mine is I'll think about it. Do you want to talk about that first and then that?
Teenagers are something else. Yes,
they are.
The other day, all three of us cried. Because I wanted to get in the car and go as fast, as far away from both of them as I could, because they were both just crying and crying and crying, and I was like, please just stop.
And as a person raised in a non-emotional family, to be in a house where someone cries 7 days a week is tough.
It's not easy, but it is a season, and I'm already starting to come out of that. Our oldest is 16. And probably within the last year and a half, she's just so much more likable. So it is a season, and it will change. In the meantime, I think you guys will have to find a balance yourself. That's something that would be a good conversation for you guys to have. Because you do need to both be on the same page with that. But at the same time, the kids need to understand that dad's working and dad's doing a great service to the family to provide. Just because dad's not here physically in this moment doesn't mean that he's not a part of it. Shoot him a text, get his opinion, vent. He has to hear a lot of venting from me, or I'll just send crying face emoticons quite frequently. But it is a season, and there is hope on the other side. I know that does not give you the answer right now that you want, but it's just a rough patch. But if you agree in what to do, if you can get a hold of him and know how to handle it. But there's really nothing else that I could say about that.
I do know practically some things we have done is we just have a straight up rule that between the two of us, if either of our kids ask either one of us something that is beyond like just normative day-to-day questions, our first question is, if they ask me, I say, have you asked your mom? And what did she say? And if they tell me, I'll say, regardless of what they tell me, I still don't give them a decision. I just want to know what they're going to tell me. And then I say, well, let me talk to your mom and I'll let you know. And then I go say, hey, one of the kids asked me this, and this is what they said you said. Is that what you said? Because number one, I want to know if I'm getting the right slant on the right story and the right statement, and then it gives us a chance to talk about it, and then I can go back and say, and a lot of times I don't know if we've consciously done this, but if we change course of direction, if I've said no and she talks me into saying yes, then I typically go back and I make the change and vice versa. So it never comes across that I said something and then she's coming behind and saying something else. So whoever made the initial call, they get to go back and say, we're changing our mind and this is why. So that it never comes across that we're working against each other. So that's something we've done. And then there, our oldest child, there's just the reality of this in most homes. Our oldest daughter has my personality and will listen to me much more quickly than she will listen to her. Our youngest daughter is much more her personality style and will listen to her more than she takes things from me. And we just know that, and we are able to say, she'll tell me a lot of times, hey, this is going on, can you talk to her about it when you get an opportunity? And that gives me the opportunity to step in and keep it from being tension between the two of them, when I can step in and say four or five sentences or have a conversation that's not highly charged and get the same result. So it's a lot of communication between the two of us about what we're going to do, and because she is left with the bulk of dealing with stuff day in, day out. Does that help in any way? Okay. If we have anybody else with a question, we'll do one more question and then take a break. Yes. I think what it has done, and you say what your thoughts on this are too, I don't do the therapy thing at home. I learned that in school. When you are going to school to be a counselor, like, you want to be the therapist all the time, and then you learn that, like, you don't have any friends and your family hates you when you're trying to be the therapist, and so you stop. And so I really am able... Like, my therapy brain is seldom on unless I'm in the therapy room doing therapy with someone. What I do observe is, like, I have a broad knowledge of just stuff. And so I know stages of human growth and development. I've done a lot of research around that. So I know, hey, we've got one that's 13, almost 14. This is going on. And this is literally the neurotransmitters that are firing this year in her brain. And so we can expect a lot of this. And so I think that comes into the marriage a good bit. But in terms of me, like, using therapy stuff and therapy tricks at home, I don't think I do that.
I don't think you do that, but there are skills that he's learned that have definitely enriched our home, enriched our church, all the way around. Things that just the way he handles situations are different now than they were pre-school.
So that would be the main thing, I think, is the educational piece has seeped in of just, it doesn't feel like, oh my word, what's going on? It's like, oh, this, they're just supposed to cry every day right now. That's just kind of what they're hardwired to do. So, all right, let's take a quick break. We'll do one more small exercise session thing here, and we'll wrap up for the day after that. Take a break and stretch your legs, and then we'll be done here within the next hour-ish. All right. If I can get a couple of people that can help me pass some things out real quickly. Just one for everybody. So there's a pretty good potential that you have heard about the five love languages. And it's by Gary Chapman. It's been around for a really, really, really long time. So everybody will get one of these. this is one of those kind of odd, just gender stereotype things. I really am, in a bunch of ways, like, such the bad stereotypical male. Like, just overwhelmingly so. So we bought the book, Five Love Languages, and my wife read it, and I was going to read it, and she read it with the idea of, I'm reading this so I can figure out how to love Devon better. I read it and came back and said, okay, I figured out how I need to be loved. And so I read it from a completely different viewpoint, which is very male and female. So what I want you to do, take a few minutes here. We'll say let's take about 10 minutes and just answer the questions. And then at the bottom of the back page, after you've answered the 30 questions, you'll count all your A, B, C, D, and E. And then tally those up so that you have the numbers there at the bottom. So everybody take a few minutes, read those, answer them, then we'll circle back around to it. About your spouse, not about other people at the table. That might have been the better question. So the second part of this is implementing it. Like, now that you know, what are you going to do about it? So now that you know how your spouse feels loved, what are you going to do about it? And so I want you to take another couple of minutes and talk about, I want you to tell your spouse, based on how you like to be loved, these are some things I'm going to do. So just take 1 or 2 minutes. I'm forcing you to have uncomfortable conversations. To have it, it's one of those things, it's tough to admit that in public, even if it did. But these are, that, what we just did, that is communication. That is at its most fundamental, basic level communication, of learning to just point out the things day to day. I think that I can say this unequivocally at this particular stage of my life. Words of affirmation are definitely my love language. And my wife does that really well. And not only does she do it well, but she's taught our children to do it well. And she models it in front of our kids, in that, like, girls, your dad works really hard. Aren't we thankful? Et cetera, et cetera. That, modeling it with your children is an important way. There's also, we don't fight in front of our kids in terms of anything we have that, like, needs to be discussed and we need to come to a marital decision on. But we also, if we're having a moment where we disagree just over an issue in general, some socio-political generic worldview, and we have a strong opinion about it, we also are not inhibited and will have those conversations in front of our kids, because your kids need to be able to see you disagree, repair that relationship, move forward, and have the understanding moving forward in life that mom and dad can disagree and we don't have to be scared that anything's wrong. So our kids, I don't think they have ever worried, is our family going to break up? Because they've seen us have some things where we didn't see eye to eye on, that we both felt really strongly about, and we talked passionately about it. And then we kept being mom and dad and husband and wife, and we moved forward. And so don't think that you have to be the perfect couple in front of your kids, because you don't, it actually is helpful for them to realize this is what good communication looks like, and this is what resolving disagreements look like. There's also, it is important to remain emotionally regulated in front of your children, and it's important to learn emotional regulation for your spouse when you're in disagreement. So emotional regulation, the part of this that I want to talk about. How many of you have ever heard the term emotional regulation? Anyone? A few of us? So what this means is how well you regulate or control your emotions. The way I explain it is if you have life events on a scale of 1 to 10, and you have the way you respond to those events on a scale of 1 to 10, if you go through Starbucks and your coffee doesn't come out the way you want it, on a life event scale, depending on how early in the morning it is, that should not get above like a 2. But if your coffee comes out wrong and you want to drag the barista through the drive-thru, your emotional response is not matching the life event. You're way over responding. If your house is on fire and you've got your phone out taking pictures, your emotional response is not matching the event. So it works both ways. There are times when your marriage is in a rough patch, you need to be on high alert. You need to be paying attention and you need to be doing the hard work. There are times with just life events happening, you need to figure out when you're reacting way up here, what are you reacting to? Because if your response is up here over something that happened down here, what's really going on? Because if you come home and there, you have no socks, clean socks, and that turns into a level 10 fight, that's not about socks. What's really going on? Because if you keep fighting about socks, you're never going to talk about what's really going on. So realize what you're having an emotional response to, and be able to keep that regulated in response to those things. Because talking about the things that are what are really, really bothering you typically ends up being not super long conversations. Trying to straighten out a fight about something that didn't really matter and then get to the heart of the issue turns into like a really protracted thing. So just like you like to do, let's just talk about it and deal with it. I am a big proponent of like, let's talk about the real issue. You're not mad at me about this because that doesn't make sense to have a response up here over this. So what's really going on? And so the emotional regulation thing is really, really important in order to effectively communicate. And the love language exercise, again, it's not new, but it was to learn to communicate. I know how you like to be loved. This is something you've done in the past few days. And this is something that I can do moving forward. That's a good model of communication. And so, just kind of to recap all of this as we're wrapping up here, starting with last night, who is our first family? And does anybody know why it's important to know that the church is our first family? Identity. We have to know what we're part of. We're not separate from the church. So what we do as a married couple is indicative of being part of the body. We have to know our identity. How many of you have ever told your kids, if you have kids, or your spouse even, this isn't a kid thing, but the Mills just don't do that. Has anybody ever said that? Like, our family just don't do that. There's something about that identity piece. knowing what your identity is. My first family is I'm part of the church. I'm part of the strongest agent of social change. I'm part of what carries the gospel, and how I talk to my wife, how I talk to my husband, how I talk to my children. It's important because fresh water and salt water, according to James, cannot flow from the same well. So if I am spewing out attacks against my spouse's character and cutting them down and criticizing and having contempt for them, how can that same well produce pure praises to God? And so we've got to keep the water clean in the well. And we do that by understanding identity, and that my marriage and my communication with my spouse is part of my worship. And then the four roadblocks that we get to good communication: criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling, or just shutting down. If we're doing those things, how can we work on that to not do that? And then expectations, saying what we need from our spouse. And what's the best way to start a sentence with your spouse? I need, I want, I feel, fill in the blank. And so affirmation is not what? Agreement. We can affirm how our spouse feels and affirm that something is important to them and make it something that we become involved with without it ever becoming the same level of priority on our list. And that's healthy marriage right there. The ebb and flow of going back and forth between, okay, this is not the same priority I have, but this is important to you, so we're going to do this. Another thing we talked about that's really important, talk about how you come across versus how your spouse comes across. The example I used last night, every hill's a hill to die on kind of thing. I'm intense about everything. You give me any topic to talk on, I can work up some passion about it. So when I come across, most of the time, it's typically impassioned. And that can feel like an attack to my wife. And so we have to have the conversation of, I'm not upset. Did it sound like I was upset? And we have to know, you're saying that and you feel like it's a 2. I feel like it's an 8. I'm going to come at you with an 8, and then you're going to go to an 8. And that's going to hurt my feelings, and it's going to be a bad day. We can circumvent all that with just a little bit of talking. And so those are the key things that we want to do. Keep our emotions regulated. Why am I really having this strong of a response? What's really making me this mad that they didn't do the dishes? Why am I really this mad that he didn't take the trash out? Because taking the trash out, while it's a good thing, it doesn't rank in the order of life as the most important thing. So why are we occupying time and space over this? Because we want to get to what's really going on. How does your spouse need to be loved, and are you loving them well? And then acknowledging back to them. So that was your quick 3-minute summary. That was the Cliff's Notes on the last 2 days. Thank you so much for how engaged you've been and how much you've been a part of this. So enjoyed doing this. Pastor Sutton, give this back to you.
Because you appreciate the good word.
I was back in the nursery. Everything's going well back there. The function of the fivefold ministry is to facilitate, to equip the people of God, the called out ones, for the work of the ministry. And here we're gaining tools and insights that will help us to be more effective in this most critical relationship, because it is really hard to do the work of the church and to do the ministry and follow the calling that God has placed on your life when you're your level of dysfunction at home is so intense and great that it cripples you. It's really hard to be effective in your ministry when you're burdened down with unresolved things at the house. And so these are wonderful tools, and I really appreciate the presentation. Really liked it when you guys were sitting here together and going back and forth. I don't know about you, but it was a very fruitful time for us all, I think. And it was very informative, and I admire your openness and vulnerability. Because at church and in public places, we want everybody to think the best of us. That's why it's possible to be a crazy family. But at church, you're just normal. Look normal, act normal, and all of that. And so we want that, but it's so refreshing to be vulnerable and to be open, and it's helpful to one another. I hear Paul saying, I can comfort you because I've been comforted, you know, and you guys have been through some things and resolved some things and are still being productive and effective in the kingdom of God. And it helps us to hear your story and your marriage testimony and all of that. And so I'm so glad you went into therapy. Are you feeling better? As you go. Now, I'm so glad to have seen you here. It's a very important meeting, I think. And why don't we spend a little time in prayer here. Brother Matt, why don't you stand and pray for us? Would you do that? Amen. Let's give God a little praise and magnify him. Thank you, Jesus. Lord God, we thank you. We praise you. We magnify you. We worship you. Blessed be your name. Glory. Amen. Felt the Holy Ghost moving all through this meeting, and I really believe God is helping us. Have a wonderful afternoon full of good fellowship, and we'll see you in the house tomorrow morning. We're blessed.